be with you.
And also with you.
Let's start with a word of prayer. Gracious God, you have promised to be with us, and today in this place and at this time, we claim that promise as our own. Be with us as we are in such a beautiful place. Make your grace shown in this community, in our hearts, in our thoughts, in our actions. Be with us in this conversation as we seek to try and understand what you're doing in the world. We ask all of this and that for which we do not know how to pray. In Christ's name, amen.
Amen.
So I'm going to do a little history of the emerging church, not too much, but just a little bit. And then after I do a little bit of history, I'll talk about what Lutherans have to offer in terms of emerging church. I'll introduce you to a few of the communities, and then I'll walk through the process of how the church I serve started. But I want you to stop me, ask questions, make comments throughout the whole time. And because I'll show you what I can here, but I really want to answer your questions more than anything. So, so the history in the emerging church. It starts in, it's actually the early 90s, that's wrong. In the early 90s, the 9 o'clock service and the late service in Sheffield in England. What happened, as you know, the UK is much more secular. It's much more post-Christian than the States. They're 10, 15, 20 years ahead of where we're going to be. And so they were looking around, and there were no young people in their churches, but all the young people were going to raves. And so they thought, well, what if we made the liturgy into a rave? And so they did this absolutely crazy thing, and they brought all this techno music in and all these videos and this crazy stuff, but it was pure Anglo-Catholic liturgy at the same time. And all the kids in town started coming. It was insane. So they said, they broke down that sacred secular thing and said, what if we took something that people saw as secular for whatever reason, brought it into church and melded the two. So what happened was, do anybody know who Sally Morgenthaler is? She wrote a book called Worship Evangelism. If you were evangelicals, you would know who she was. She was born and raised Lutheran, and she became evangelical in college. Now she's kind of gone back. She's taken me under her wing. She lives in Colorado and insists that we have lunch once a month so she can help me. She's a wonderful, wonderful mentor. She got a hold of a pirated VHS tape of this service, and she is a worship expert in the evangelical church. And so she started showing this thing at these conferences she would go to, and it blew everybody's mind. And all of a sudden, their imaginations were sparked in terms of what church could be and what it could look like and what could be present in church. And that really is the genesis of the emerging church in the States. So then there was an organization called Emergent. You might be familiar with Emergent Village, and that started in 1999, and it was a bunch of young, arrogant white men. So they're my friends, I mean, but they're wrong. So there are two scholars at Fuller Seminary. Strangely enough, Fuller, an evangelical seminary, is on the cutting edge of emerging church scholarship. So they have two scholars, Ryan Bulger and Eddie Gibbs. And they spent 4 years, and they went to house churches and emerging churches and all these crazy churches, spent 4 years with these people and put together a book, which is based on that research. So they describe it this way. They identify with the life of Jesus, transform the secular realm, live highly communal lives, and because of these activities, they welcome the stranger, serve with generosity, participate as producers, create as created beings, lead as a body, and take part in spiritual activities. So most of the people that they studied were not mainliners. They were not from the Anglo-Catholic tradition or the Lutheran tradition. They were people who were coming out of more of an evangelical tradition, which brings me to this. There are three kind of distinct streams in the emerging church, and this is why it's a really problematic term. So is that the term emerging church is applied broadly to things that are actually antithetical to each other. So it's almost useless as a term. But there's three streams. There's the post-evangelical. So if you've read any Brian McLaren, he's definitely a post-evangelical. So these are people who are in an evangelical church, and they're sort of questioning the focus and certainty of their evangelical theology. So they're thinking, wait a minute, maybe Christians should be engaged in social justice. And they're thinking, maybe the kingdom of God is at hand, and not just this heaven that we go to, and that's what we concern ourselves with. And they're thinking, maybe scripture isn't this, it isn't inerrant, infallible, all these things. They're becoming Lutherans. So they're people who are really kind of deconstructing the certainty and the structures and the unquestioned stuff from their evangelical tradition. So there's a whole stream of that. Then there's the mainline stream. So these are like Church of the Apostles in Seattle, my church. A lot of mainline churches are realizing that their denominations are dying, and they're willing to try anything, even letting someone like me start a church. So other mainline denominations are doing this as well. Now, the people in the UK who are doing emerging church fit really in this category. They're not rethinking their theology quite as much as they're diving really deeply into their tradition within a cultural context that they find themselves. So that's different than saying, oh, I'm going to completely deconstruct all of my theology. So the Lutherans who are doing this work, we're not deconstructing our theology. We're diving much more deeply into it. So then there's these people, who's like Mark Driscoll at Mars Hill in Seattle. If anyone's heard of that guy,
yeah.
He's a piece of work. So the not so post evangelicals. And now I'm gonna completely lack generosity in my assessment of my brothers and sisters in Christ for a moment. So please forgive me in advance. These folks have not questioned any of their theology. They haven't questioned any of the certainty. They merely have decided that if they adopt a hipster veneer in the city, that they can convince people that they're safe and that they're different and this isn't your mother's church, blah, blah, blah. And then, but you scratch below the surface and it's the same bad theology. And so there's a bait and switch there. And they'll have a kind of hipster veneer, but it's the same old stuff. So for instance, Mark Driscoll in Seattle is a hyper-Calvinist and a hyper-masculinist. And so he believes the problem with the church is the feminization of the church. And so he preaches the importance of gender stratification. And
where's Rob Bell?
Rob Bell on here? Rob Bell's more of a post-evangelical, I would say. He's not quite as radical as some of the others, but yeah, he would be post-evangelical.
Mark Driscoll calls that whole gender stratification
complementarianism, correct. Yeah.
So it sounds much better.
It sounds great, yeah. sign me up. So when people are like, so you're like in the emerging church, like Mark Driscoll, I'm like, yeah. You know, it's like, it's pretty broad. And so it becomes a really problematic term. When I use the term, I use it very, very, in a very specific way. And I mean something very specific. So when I use the term, I mean this. That emerging churches, when I'm talking about them, are Christian communities that emerge out of a very particular cultural context in which the traditional church is irrelevant. And that context is more often than not urban, young, and postmodern. So that's what I'm talking about when I use the term. And there are not a lot of emerging churches, but there is a lot of emerging church conversation. So there's websites and books and articles and tons and tons of stuff that is part of the emerging church conversation. So if there's a suburban church and their pastor's read a bunch of emerging church books and is very inspired by it and wants to start a kind of groovy contemplative thing at night in, you know, on Sunday nights in the suburbs, I would consider that part of the emerging church conversation. So they're influenced in maybe participating in the conversation. I wouldn't consider that an emerging church necessarily. But, you know, I'm one voice. So also, with the post-evangelicals, so with Tony Jones, Doug Padgett, I don't know if anybody's familiar with these guys, they're part of Emergent Village. I disagree with them. They're dear friends of mine, and I disagree with them wholeheartedly on several things. Because what they've done is they've decided that there's no use for denominations, that they're sinful, burdensome structures, that you can't be tied to the dead weight of a denomination and be missional, that there's no need for ordination because nobody's ontologically different or special, and that there's no need for traditional seminary education. And I could not disagree more about those three things. So one of the hallmarks, and I'm just going to go through a few of them about the emerging church, is that there's this idea of an ancient future faith. So some of these emerging churches are diving very deeply into the Christian tradition. Like I mentioned last night, House does a Gregorian chant setting of the liturgy, a cappella. So that we chant the Psalms, that we, some of the people practice contemplative prayer. We did an entire triduum, I'll go into that tomorrow. The whole Monday, Thursday, Easter vigil, the whole thing. And to go through an entire triduum with a community that's creating every piece of it, it took everybody in the community to do it. And
can you talk about what that is?
Oh, sorry. Monday, Thursday, Good Friday, and Easter Vigil.
Oh, okay.
It's one liturgy. It's considered. There's no dismissal at the end of Monday, Thursday, or Good Friday, technically. It's one liturgy that you do over 3 days. And that to go through this ancient ritual of the church, 80% of the people at House had never been to a Holy Week service in their lives. And here they are creating this ancient, beautiful expression of church. So, I love that picture. There's a lot of things that are different about each of these communities. So you can't break it down to worship or music or aesthetic or anything. But one thing that most of them share is a sense of irony. That's present in almost all emerging churches. So a lot of times it's hard to see where the reverence ends and where the irreverence begins. You know, it's really blended. Like the back of my shirt, this is our church shirt, and it says, "Radical Protestants nailing shit to the church door since 1517. Well, you know, most Lutheran churches aren't going to probably have that on the back of their church, their golf shirts, you know. But for our community, it's totally appropriate. Like, we're proud of that, you know, and we think it's great. So. And then there's an engagement with the arts. This is the Well in Charlotte, North Carolina. Has anyone ever been there? It's an ELCA church. It's a coffee shop and a worship space both for this community. And they have lots of concerts there, and it's really used as a front porch in the community. Like I mentioned, there's sort of breaking down the sacred secular thing. And that there's a focus on being missional and contextual. So what I mean by that is that to be missional is basically to ask the question, what is God up to in our community and in this context, and how can we participate in that? So rather than thinking everyone has to come to us so we can give them God and give them church and Jesus, that we're going to go out into the world because God is there. God's at work there. That's why I still go to AA meetings 17 years later, is because sometimes I have to hear what God is up to in my neighborhood, you know? And that's where I end up hearing it a lot of times. So that's what the sort of missional thing is. So for the evangelicals, this was huge, this idea that maybe God is up to things outside of the church and that we can go and participate in those. So then the contextual idea, and this is enormous, especially in the community I serve, is that, and I'll go through that in a second, we went through a lot of work to figure out what characterizes us and the people in our context, in our neighborhood, and given that, what does it look like to be church? So we jettisoned all methodology for starting a church, all of it. Okay, so why Lutheranism is so perfect for all of this, the liturgy, that ancient future faith, that is such a huge, huge gift. A lot of evangelicals, so cute, but they've discovered the liturgy like it was lost. And so there are lots of evangelicals right now, the post-evangelicals, and they're like discovering the joy of liturgy and trying to like incorporate stuff. Right now I'm involved in a project called the Denver Book of Prayer, and it's 12 missional communities who are, some are considered kind of emerging churches, some not. We're the only, City Presbyterian, so two mainline groups, and then 10 evangelical churches or post-evangelical that are in the city. And we're writing a prayer book together, and each of us is taking a month. And using the church, the church calendar, using the liturgical year, grounding our prayer in that, introducing each other to saints that are important to us. So all these evangelicals are really hungry for that. Like, they get what they've lost in terms of their own heritage as the church. So that's a huge gift. And then our theology, the emphasis on grace, all of the ambiguity and the tension in our theology, the fact that we're simultaneously saint and sinner, that we're justified in the sort of in the now and the not yet, all of that stuff is perfectly suited for a postmodern world. I mean, we really have a huge gift to offer at this point. The simul justus, they eat that up. That is the joy. That is one of the joys of what I get to do, is I get to liberate people's theologies. You know, they're told this very small, very tight, very, you know, uptight sort of theology, and then we'll have all these conversations, and I get to break that stuff open for them, and they just look at me like, I had no idea. It was the experience I had when I went to St. Paul's. I had no idea you could even think about it like that. And it means a lot. And then also our view of scripture. The fact that we take it seriously but not literally. The fact that it's the cradle that holds Christ. And that we honor it enough to struggle with it and to question it and to be engaged in it and to allow it to interpret us. That is beautiful. Okay, so I'm going to just tell you about a few. Spirit Garage was the first in the ELCA. It's actually 11 or 12 years old. These slides are old. It is a ministry of Bethlehem Lutheran, which is a huge, rich church in Minneapolis. And they realized that in their neighborhood that there was a changing demographic. And so there were a lot of young adults moving in, and they realized what we have to offer might not be really what they're into. So let's just start something else and let them determine what it's going to be. And so that was the first of the sort of emerging churches. And their whole thing is faith, love, and rock and roll. So they have the rock and roll band, not much liturgy. It's not something I would probably go to, but the people who go really love it, and they're very loud. And then I talked about the well a little bit. This is Todd Zielinski. They've been around 9 years, I think, something like that. And it's a coffee shop. And what he did when he went to Charlotte is he wanted to kind of read the culture and the context there. And he realized that there's a front porch culture in that town, that's where everyone was engaging and interacting. And so he's like, how could we have a big front porch? So that's what they opened the well. And that's their front porch, the community, that they can engage with people. And this is Church of the Apostles in Seattle, which I talked about a little bit yesterday. That's the Fremont Abbey, and they have the Fremont Arts Council in there. We start and end with a blank space every Sunday, and it takes a lot of work to set it up and to break it all down. And I was like, oh, wouldn't it be great just if we owned our own building? Well, they do own this building, and they start and end with a blank space because the entire community is using that building all week long. And they feel like that's part of their mission. So she's a creative genius. She applied, I guess you can apply to the ELCA youth gathering to get monies from their offering, something like this. So she got a grant from that. And what she did, they're in Fremont, which is a really expensive area to live in, and a lot of her parishioners can't really afford to to live in the apartments around there. But they really want to be a presence in that neighborhood. And so she applied for the money, and what she did was the church put first and last month's rent and the security deposit down for two or three houses right around the church building. And then they have these intentional communities of young adults who come to the church living in the neighborhood. And the church gets to kind of say who lives there and who doesn't. They kind of keep tabs on it. But that's how what she did with the grant money was now it allows those people, the people in the church, to really live in the neighborhood because they consider themselves to be missionaries and apostles in their neighborhood.
I think she got a loan from the Mission Investment Fund.
Did she? For the building? Yeah, she did. For that was a Lutheran church that had merged, I think, with another church. Church of the Beloved is a church plant of Church of the Apostles. So Church of the Apostles is like 6-7 years old. Now they planted another church in Edmonds, Washington with Ryan Marsh, who I'm trying to get on teaching staff here because he's a genius. The guy is amazing. If you ever get a chance to hear him talk, he's incredible. And then this is our church logo, and that's what's on the front of our website. House for All Sinners and Saints is a group of folks figuring out how to be a liturgical, Christocentric, social justice-oriented, queer, inclusive, incarnational, contemplative, irreverent, ancient future church with a progressive but deeply rooted theological imagination. That's all. We wanted to start small.
Is there a reason you don't mention in it that you're Lutheran?
Yeah, that was really hard for me because I'm a company girl and I struggled with that. But I've had people, we are on the ELCA website.
Seal.
Yep, yeah, there's clues, you know, if you know what you're looking for. Also, our, can I get the wireless signal in here?
Yes.
Our, oh gosh, I'm going to do this and I might regret it, but our website. I got nothing here, too.
Don. Don.
Oh, okay.
What's your website?
Houseforall.org. It's just not letting me.
You have to get into the wireless with the password.
Yeah, I've done. Okay, hold on. I think I have the. Okay, hold on. Here it is. I had it up so that I might be able to show you. No. Okay,
yeah.
Okay,
this.
207. Okay, don't start. Well, I don't know how to show it to you, to like show you the whole thing, but so go to view. Okay.
Zoom.
We're gonna zoom. It's still okay. Sorry. Okay. Anyway, it looks like a church door with a bunch of stuff nailed to it. So that's kind of Lutheran. That was all for that. Okay. Say what?
Only 99 things.
Yeah, 99. So I have had people who have come to the church and who are, we don't have members, but who are basically members now, who told me if it said Lutheran, they wouldn't have come. And the people who want to find a Lutheran church find us, because all the Lutherans in town know about us, and we're on the ELCA site. And that kind of broke my heart to do. There are some things that I, like some things were sort of non-negotiables for me going in, and some things were not. And that's one thing that wasn't, and I let it go. Just like we don't say the creed, which kills me. I love the creed. But there are so many non-creedal people in the community. And it's a may rubric in the liturgy. It's not a will rubric, meaning it's optional. So I had to let that one go. Yeah.
So do you know why they want to steer away from Lutheran in Denver? I mean, usually I know people who are so conservative they don't want to do the ELCA, but
yeah. Organized religion, large denomination, people who came from conservative evangelical upbringings where Lutheran was a bad word, and even though they're out of it, they still were like, you know?
Well, those of us raised in the Missouri Senate.
Missouri Senate?
Have a real attitude about, I personally wouldn't step foot in the church myself.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I have several, you know, Missouri, people who were raised Missouri Synod, there's lots of reasons. So I kind of feel like the Lutherans find us. It does kill me a little bit, but I get it. So if I'm not willing to sort of die to self kind of over and over, this thing will never work. So I just have to decide what are the things I have to stand fast on, what things can I let go. Yeah.
Maybe at some point you can write your own version of the creed.
Yeah, we were going to do, I think at some point during Open Space, which I'll talk about tomorrow, we're going to do a creed redux where we put up all the lines of the creed and people can rewrite them or use different images or language or something and then construct something. I'm kind of down with the Nicene, but that's okay. Here's the story. Here's the history of this church. I knew, if you were here last night, you heard the whole story. And so in the fall of 2005 is when I sort of realized this is what I'm called to do. But I had just started seminary. So I started a theology pub in a local hipster hangout in summer of 2006 as a way to sort of be in public, and people could know who I am and just be in conversation. So there were three rules for theology pub. One is that nobody was allowed to try and convince anybody of anything. Two is that nobody was allowed to imply that they knew the truth and someone else didn't. And third, it's Christian theology, no like half Buddhist bullshit. So there's enough in our tradition to talk about, you know, so I didn't want to get off and all this other stuff. So those were the three rules, and it was never an issue. It was always really fun. And all different kinds of people came. It's on hiatus right now. But I did it for 3 years, every month. And it was super fun. I had this little card, and it said, for the reverently unorthodox and the irreverently orthodox, or something like that. So then, in winter of 06, the mission director for my synod got together other pastors that were close, all the Denver pastors. Because I don't know how it works in other synods, but if you want to start a new Lutheran church, you have to get buy-in from the people who are closest to you. No competing franchises and weirdness. So I knew these people because we'd been in the Senate for a while. And so they all said, absolutely, we think it's needed and we want to support it. So then the first, what I did was I literally kept a little notebook, and I would talk about what I was going to do all the time. I was kind of like a crazy woman. I'm going to start a church. And so everyone's like, yeah, that's great. Good luck with that, you know? Like, most people are like, that doesn't sound like it's as easy as you're, you know? And so, actually, when I was here 2 years ago, I saw on the list of people coming in that there was someone else coming to work on Waytry that was from Denver. And I thought, ooh, I have to see who this is, because I knew I was going to start a church. And so, literally, I waited for her. She came off the bus. And it's Victoria Shotwell. She was on housekeeping. She just left on Monday. And she's very sort of, she's a timid sort of introverted girl. And I go, hey, are you from Denver? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, I'm going to start a church. And so she's like, ah. So she got that, like, I get that, like, big eye, back off, you know, thing. And so I gave her some stuff. And then, lo and behold, a couple months after I came back, she emailed me. So she's like, are you still starting that church? And she can be very, you know, introverted and shy. And the story was, she had gone to an ELCA church in town for 3 or 4 years. And for 2 years, she'd been on the church council. And the pastor got her name wrong after 2 years of being on the church council. And she thought, I want to be in a community where people notice my contributions, you know, where, like, I'm needed. And I'm like, I need you. And so I kept a list of everyone who said, I'm really interested, let me know when you start. And I'd say, okay, and I'd write their name down. And so I had this list of like probably 10 people. And I emailed them and said, hey, you said you were interested in this, let's all have dinner. So we got together 2 years ago and we had dinner. And there were like, I think 7 or 8 people there. And we just got to know each other and talked a little bit about what we imagined. And it was no big deal. So then, for 6 months after that, I had to go to Luther Seminary for my year of righteousness. Well, it was like 4 months. It was like 4 months of righteousness. And but I commuted home every week and a half to 2 weeks during that time. So during that period, that fall of 2007, these people, there were 9 people total, eight people and myself, would meet in my living room once a month. And we'd share a meal and we'd pray together. And that's it. We didn't try and get more people in the group. And all I wanted were people who were willing to do it for, if you can commit to 6 months of this, and then if you don't think it's right for you, fine, but I need people who will commit to it. I don't care what your skill set is, what your background is, I just need people who will do it. Because here was the catch-22 with all of this, is that I felt like we needed people who would be attracted to it and come and be committed. But the only way that would happen is if we actually had something to offer. But we would never have something to offer until people committed to it. And it was, you know, that was a horrible time for me. It was so difficult. So anybody who showed up and said, I will do this, I just wanted to kiss their feet. And so there were 8 people who said, we're going to do it. We're going to meet together, and we really think this has some potential. So we did that, and then, while I was at Luther, 2 of them called me, and I was coming home, and I had 2 weeks. So like I mentioned yesterday, the church very foolishly said that I could start a church as my internship, which had never happened before. And so I was leaving Luther, and January 1st of 2008 was when my internship started, and they let me off with 10 months. I didn't even have to do 12. So... And they were like, all right, if you really think it'll work, do whatever you want. You have to raise your own money. And you know, if something is there in 10 months, we'll judge whether it's worthy to be an official mission development. And if it is, then we'll ordain you to it. So I had 2 weeks between ending Luther and starting the internship. And during that time, 2 of the girls call me and go, can we have an Advent prayer service? And I'm like, I have to settle into my family, so I'm not going to really plan an Advent prayer service. They go, oh, we'll do it. And I go, all right, great. So they did it. It's in the basement of a bar. And there were 6 of us from this group of 9. And we met for a few minutes, then we're going to start at 4. And I look around, 21 people came into the basement of a bar I'd never seen in my life for an Advent prayer service. And I thought, what in the world? And Seth played her cello, and we wrote down what we were waiting for in our own lives, this idea of waiting. What am I waiting for in my own life? And then we hung them on these Christmas lights that we'd strung up. And everyone walked around and read what everyone had written. And they were so beautiful and devastating and just incredible. And the people who had invited their friends checked in with their friends and said, what did you think of this? And a couple of them said, I feel like there's no space in my life where my deepest longings can be held and voiced. And we thought, that's our charge. That's why we're doing this. And so that was beautiful. And then we tried to, it says weekly meetings, which is very deceiving. We tried to meet weekly and it just didn't work. People's schedules were weird. 3 people would show up 1 week, 7 people the next. It's a really difficult time, those first months. So then we decided, well, let's just do something out in the community that would be funny and quirky. So we did Fat Tuesday at a bar called The Thin Man. And so we did it this year, too. So now we have traditions, like Holden. We do something twice, and it's tradition. So it's been this weird thing of when you have a brand new church, if you did something last year, you do it again this year. You know? And that's a tradition, and people love it. So... is there a fan or something in here? It's like really hot. Yeah, open the door. Oh, so we did this year too at the Thin Man. The Thin Man's this bar. It's literally a bar. Like, there's a bar and then some tables. That's it. But behind the bar, all these pictures of Jesus everywhere. It's very strange. So the owner was actually raised Lutheran. He converted to Orthodoxy, but he loves that we're doing this crazy church. And so the Bible study that we do is in the basement of the Thin Man. So we handed out like 6 dozen donuts, because you know in the medieval church, you would the day before Lent started, you would clear out the pantry of all your fat and sugar that you wouldn't be consuming during Lent. So you'd have a party and make pancakes and donuts and all that stuff. That's where that pancake dinner thing came from. So we handed out donuts, and then there's this thing called post-secret. People know what this is, post-secret. If you don't, Google it, it's brilliant. This guy had this, it was an art project where he invited his friends to write down their secrets on homemade postcards. And he was gonna do an art installation. Well, now hundreds of thousands of people have made homemade postcards and written their secrets and mailed them to him. He has books, you can go to Barnes and Noble, see books full of them. So we had a stack of blank postcards and we addressed them to Post Secret and we stamped them. And we gave them to everyone in the bar saying that we were pretty sure they'd want to confess their sins because Lent was starting tomorrow. And we gave them postcards. And then we had come up with 40 ideas for keeping a holy Lent. So we came up with a different thing each day. We handed that out. And on there was inviting them to Ash Wednesday. That first year, I was preaching at St. Paul's downtown. So we invited them to that. And then the second year, we had our own liturgy, and we invited them to that. Nobody came. But that's all right. We had fun. So this first year, then we, for Lent, we had a service where it was a covenant service, just these 8 people and myself. And they covenanted with each other over Lent to pray every day for for what we were doing and to share a meal with another person in the community that week, and they would change who that was. And so we wanted to go through the process of discernment and start it there. So and each of the conversations were the same for each week. They'd have a topic. So whoever you shared a meal with, you would have a conversation, and then come back that Sunday and everyone would talk about it. It didn't work that well, but some people did it. And so then we went on a retreat over Holy Week. We did a very condensed Triduum. We did all 3 services in a day and a half, very, very condensed. But what we did is we went through a process of discernment. And what we did was we said, what characterizes us and our friends and our partners and the people in our cultural context? How can we characterize what that is? What is that cultural context? We did all this work. We came up with some stuff. And then we said, based on that, what does it look like to be church? So it's actually in my, well, now I'm going to get in trouble. Hold on. In my slideshow for tomorrow. And there it is. This is what we came up with. Now, this is us. This is not who everyone should be. We're people who went to church once and are now evangelical refugees. We're people who never stopped going to church yet are seeking a community that provides a different level of engagement. We are youngish and adultish. We resonate more with the mystical and the contemplative than the obvious and simplistic. We work in nonprofits. We are graduate students, social workers, and young professionals. We participate in virtual culture and are tech savvy enough to realize that we are not, actually. We are artists who mediate progressive culture outside the mainstream. We're postmodern urban dwellers who are delighted to not live close to such things as Applebee's. We're terminally ironic, white, and educated. We're the injured who are striving to be self-aware. Struggle is an almost constant. Our cynicism can sometimes just be masking our confusion and vulnerability. Our idealism is based in the trust that transformation is possible in the individual, church, and the world. Oh, what happened?
Guess you're right about that tech savvy, isn't it?
Right, exactly. That's case in point. Some are queer. Some have children, some live alone, some are alone, some are partnered. We tend to overthink things because we're geeky and analytical. Some of us are rooted here, but most are somewhat transient, and we are friends and allies of all the above. So when we went on retreat, these 9 people, are you protesting me? Oh, okay. Us. And then what does it look like to be church in our context with other people who probably these things are also true? And so we said, well, let's do a public liturgy. What the hell, right? So April 13th of last year, we had our first public liturgy, which I'll talk about tomorrow. And then we did that monthly until November. And then we started BYOB, Bring Your Own Brain Bible Study. And that's in the basement of the bar. It's every week. It's a lectionary Bible study. And it is a blast. I talk to other pastors. I'm like, oh my God, my Bible study is so fun. They're like, really? We just laugh. It's wonderful. And I love, as their preacher, listening to how they're hearing the text before I have to write the sermon is great. And then, ta-da, we were in official mission development by November 1st of last year. And then we started weekly worship in Advent. And I was ordained in November as well. So these are just pictures from, this is before we went a cappella, but these are just a couple pictures from that first liturgy. I'll go more into it tomorrow. I have tons of pictures from liturgy. I'll just tell you, we did Stations of the Resurrection at our first liturgy, and each of us curated, we took one of the resurrection accounts in scripture and curated some kind of station around it to help people experience it. This is one I did that was that Mark 20 text where Mary encounters Jesus and she mistakes him for the gardener. You know, she never lived that down with her friends. Can you imagine? How embarrassing. So this is an icon of Mary Magdalene, but it has that text up until he says, and Jesus said her name Mary. It's in big quotes. And all the way down here are quote marks with a line. And people just wrote their name in there. You know, she didn't know who he was till he said her name, which is just so beautiful. Somebody wrote queer child. It's just, it's incredible. So that was our first liturgy. That's a poem about the resurrection my friend Cheryl wrote that I put pictures to and hung up. Anyway, so that's it. Okay, I want to answer questions now.
When you say the part about white,
that was really hard for us. We were all white people, and we didn't want to say we weren't. And does that mean that we're going to stay white? No, hopefully not. But we were describing who we were. And we struggled with that one. I mean, that was a really interesting conversation that weekend. But we had to say, you know what? We're educated white folks. That's who we are.
That's who we're, like, who you are at the moment.
Totally. That's all it was. It was descriptive, not prescriptive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk about the way in which the congregation is missional? How? Mm-hmm. My experience of church has been that's been sort of the fine print at the bottom that mm-hmm. it's easy to ignore.
What do you mean by that part?
Being engaged in the world around you.
Uh huh. Yeah. Well, we're engaged in the world around us in the fact that we are people who gather around Word and Sacrament and then are sent out into the world. And so, like, Victoria talks about the fact that she's one of the few people who went to church her whole life. She always went to church. But now, this is the first time she talks about it. So she's never talked about being, nobody at work knew she went to church. It was never something she talked about, it's just something she did. Now she talks about it. So that's being missional. And so, for instance, there's a bike culture in Denver. And a lot of people in our community don't have cars, they only ride bikes. And so we did, I'll talk about it tomorrow, we did a blessing of the bicycles. Invited the bicycling community, had these amazing posters, did all this stuff. Like, that's completely missional. That's saying, like, here's the thing in our community. We want to bless it. We want to ask for protection for the people who can't afford to have a car, don't have a choice, or for people who are choosing to commute, or the pedicab people, or whatever. And we did this reading from Ezekiel. The wheel was lifted above the people, and the piece, you know, this bizarre, like, prophetic text that talks about a wheel. We're like, oh, what the hell? We'll read that. And and we, I did aspersion, you know, with the tassel-y things at the end of the handlebars, you know. It was great. It was beautiful, you know. I guess more than, and like, we do a Bible study in a bar. Everyone knows who we are. Like I said last night, I refuse to have an office, so I'm out in the community all the time. And I'm having conversations with people who probably will never go to my church. And, like, they kind of consider me their pastor. So, yeah.
Did you have baptisms at that Triduum?
Yeah, we did. I'll show you pictures tomorrow. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Do you take an offering?
We don't. We have a basket at the welcome table where people leave their tithes. We don't. That's another sort of missional thing. Being aware of people's baggage around the church, that's a choice we've made. We might eventually. I want to do it during Lent. Like, too bad, we're taking an offering. It's Lent. And you need to suffer. Yeah.
So how are you paid?
How am I paid? I'm paid by the denomination. They pay my salary. I don't know for how long. Our funding, interestingly enough, they pay part of my salary. And then we pay part of it. And then some partner congregations in the Senate pay part of my salary. And that's it. We get no operating expenses from the ELCA, nothing. And so I go and sing for my supper a lot at Lutheran churches and describe the ministry. And then people who for whom they just see maybe this tradition dying around them, and then they see it having new life here, they say, I want to support that. I put up a PayPal thing on my blog and on the church website. Strangers give us money. Complete strangers give us money because they're excited by what we're doing. I have no idea. And then there's this process where somebody in the congregation writes them thank yous. So it's not from me. It's not from the church. It's from an individual in the community saying thank you and for making this possible for someone like me. And they say a little bit about who they are. So it really is, this ministry is really funded by the generosity of other Christians completely. I would say half of my community has no income. They're either graduate students, or they're Urban Servant Corps volunteers, or they're unemployed. And the other half that has I call them the overeducated, voluntarily poor. So the people who make all the money in my community are inner city public school teachers, social workers, and people who work for nonprofits. So the half that has an income, that's the income. And we have one lawyer.
How did your congregation grow, like, word of mouth?
Totally word of mouth. We don't do any advertising. So now I would say we have 54 people. And we had, so of those 9, 2 of them moved 2 months after that because they had to go to graduate school. So we were 7. So now we have like 54, I would say, who consider it their church. 35 to 40 that are really active. And in liturgy we have between... Well, we usually have around 40 people in liturgy, except for Easter Vigil when we had 70. So I don't know of any other church that doubles their, you know, the attendance on the vigil, you know. But it was a huge ordeal. So, do you? Really? Where are you at?
City Ridge Lutheran in Seattle.
Yes, yeah. You guys do it up, yeah?
It's packed.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It should well, everybody be packed. Brings guests.
Yeah, totally. That's what happened at ours, too. So it's all word of mouth. Some people have found us on the internet. Some people see what I write on like Christian Century or God's Politics or somewhere else, And then they go, oh, she's from Denver. I live in Denver. I'm going to go check that out. So some people have come that way. But mostly it's people's friends. People invite their friends. Yeah.
I know you, I imagine you hate this question, but do you think you have a vision of what you want to be in 3 years, or you just want to see how you get there?
Yeah. No, my mission director keeps trying to make me do that. You have to have a 6- and a 12-month plan. I'm like, okay, my 6- and 12-month plan is to be a responsive, adaptive leader. It's the same as my 1-week plan. Well, and what I mean by that, it's a very transient population. So 6 people are leaving our community in August. Yeah, it's like, what, 10-15%, you know? So who we are changes with everyone who comes in and leaves. And so who we are determines who we are and what we do. And so I want to be responsive to what people's needs are, how we're present in the community, and adapt to who comes in. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I don't. And you know what? This freaks people out. But like, if for 5 years a community has Word and Sacrament Ministry and they hear the gospel, and then it ends and becomes something else or doesn't, it's still successful to me. It's really hard because our church has been all about longevity and keeping it going, and you know what I mean? That's what so much of our money and energy in our denomination goes for. So this idea, well, why would you put money into something that's not going to be around? I think it will, but if it's not, if it's not around in 5 years, I would never see it as a failure, because I've seen how people's lives have been transformed by Word and Sacrament and Christian community. Yeah.
Well, we're kind of anchored in brick and mortar.
Yeah. Oh, you want to hear about the building?
Sure.
Okay. So 2 or 3 years ago, someone said, when I was like, I'm going to start a church, they were like, well, what would your ideal space be? You know, like a middle school gym or a storefront or a warehouse? I'm like, 100-year-old church building with no pews. That's the ideal space. I had no idea our Synod owned one downtown. So this is the thing about all of this. Anybody who says, oh, you know, you're amazing, this work you're doing, oh, it's so great you're doing this, I'm like, you have to understand how many other people give money, how many things have gone, have all these doors that have opened, how many rules that other people have broken, how many people, it's not, I just have this one role in it, and it's public. But I could not have created that. That was like the Holy Spirit, you know? So there's a long story to the building. During White Flight, it disbanded as a congregation in the 60s. It was originally a Danish immigrant church. And it's been, for 18 years, it's been a Native American community center. It's been given to the Native Americans rent free. So we share the space, together with the Native American community.
And Nadia?
Yeah.
You're paid partially by the Synod.
No.
No?
Mm-mm.
The denomination?
Yeah.
Okay, the denomination.
Yeah.
Denomination, and then some churches.
Yep.
I'd say, I think you're doing this great. Okay. I think it's wonderful, and I think it's needed. And I'm hearing who your congregation is, and I see a lot of people out there, and they don't like the traditional church.
Yeah.
And let's say we threw a lot of people into the churches like that, and say we took our churches and we revamped all of our churches and we made them like that.
Wouldn't work.
Yeah. No,
who's going to pay the ministry?
Yeah, no, please don't revamp your churches to make them like mine. They'll die. it's a very valid point. I think that it can kind of tweak people a little bit, that here's this community and someone else is paying their bills, you know, and they should pull themselves up by their bootstraps or whatever.
But don't a lot of mission churches start that way?
They do, but a lot of mission churches are started in the suburbs, where all they need is some seed money, and then eventually they can take care of themselves. My church might never be that.
It's outreach.
It's outreach. And the thing is that it's also inspiring a lot of other people. And so I get emails from all over saying, oh, I'm following your church, and thanks for putting stuff on the internet, and I think maybe we'll try a blessing of the motorcycles or what, you know, whatever. And so it's this sort of the innovative edge of the church has to have, if people see it as having some value, then it has to be sort of resourced from the center. If all the church was like that, obviously it wouldn't work. So
I'm just thinking back to the beginning of AA, mm-hmm. when everything in AA is volunteer.
Yeah.
All our leadership was volunteers.
Yeah.
And they needed a janitor, and nobody would be the janitor. And then they realized if they didn't pay a janitor, they wouldn't have one.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's why some of the my post-evangelical friends, Tony and Doug, say, well, we don't need full-time clergy, we don't need paid clergy, all of that. And I disagree, not just because I want to protect my job, because of the fact that that one of the most missional things I have going for me is I have a top-notch theological education. That makes all the difference in my context. It makes all the difference. The fact that I can finally articulate and put into words that people understand a very complicated theology, but then articulate it to them in a way that they can get it, and that it speaks to their lives. That's as a result of that's not my cleverness. You know, that's a result of the education that I have. And the fact that I am very present in their lives. They have a pastor, and a lot of them have never had a pastor before. I think that there's a huge value in that. You know, maybe I'll have to be half-time at some point and then just make money doing other stuff, be bivocational. Yeah, back there.
You know, I'm not a Lutheran, so I'm listening, and there are a lot of foreign words being used, and, you know, I feel like I need a dictionary or something,
yeah.
But I came out of a tradition of intense fundamentalism.
Yeah.
Little tiny churches, I mean, it was like there was a building and four or five families. Literally, our theology changed depending on who the preacher was.
Yeah.
And typically, the pastor worked at Sears, mm-hmm. or was a farmer or whatever,
sure.
and then pastored in his spare time.
Sure.
Once a month, mm-hmm. the pastor was pounded, which means people brought food and piled it up so that the pastor and his family could eat.
Yeah.
It was traditional to feed the entire pastor's family on Sunday, which could be a real ordeal for some people because they tend to have lots of children.
Yeah.
But it wasn't good. Mm-hmm. It was not a good thing to have an uneducated pastor who simply walked up on Sunday morning into the pulpit, opened the Bible, and said, here's what the Holy Spirit has laid on me today. You know, and I would never, ever doubt their sincerity.
Sure. Yeah.
But what you're saying is absolutely true.
This is one of the things I learned in writing my book, was that I was studying these people like Paula White and Jesse Duplantis and Joel Osteen, all these people, and here's why it's great to have a denomination, is because, you know what? I have a very charismatic personality, and I can get people to do stuff. And what I need are people looking over my shoulder and keeping me on the yellow brick road. What I don't need and what my church doesn't need is me preaching on whatever text I feel like they need to hear that day. That me just wandering off in whatever I think they should be doing. Like, the only way it works with any sort of integrity for me to do this is to be deeply rooted, not only in a theological tradition, but in a denomination that's not going to let me spin off into some craziness.
One of the things that's really important to me as a pastor who's in a mainline suburban congregation, who's been spending her sabbatical on this very topic of how do mainline suburban congregations reach out to young adults, that's really important to me is to ask the question of not only of you but for us, what are you telling us is transferable? Not how can I take what you've done and repeat it?
Yeah, thank you.
But how can I take this information and transfer it? And two things come to mind for me, not only from what you've said, but from what I've been studying, and that is, forgive pastors out of their offices. I need to get
totally.
Out of my office and get with the young adults in my congregation more and with young adults out in the community and hear what is what their longings are.
Totally. Absolutely.
And, you know, so why aren't you at my church? You know,
tell me.
Yeah. So that's one piece. Mm-hmm. The other is if it is a priority of a congregation, mm-hmm. if we really long that much have more young adults
mm-hmm.
in the lives of our congregation, then we need to be willing to share our pastors with those young adults that are not in the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And make a commitment collectively
mm-hmm.
that our pastor may not be there when we want to tell them the story about our grandkid. That
totally. No,
wonderful.
You're absolutely right, because congregations have this subtle, very subtle thing about the pastor justifies their paycheck by how much they're in the office.
Well,
and how much they're available to you whenever you want them.
And it really, it's a lovely relationship in many, many ways, but it is a chaplaincy relationship.
It is. And so this is something I really struggle with, because people email me and they go, what can I be doing? What can I do like you're doing? And I really struggle with knowing, because replicating stuff's not going to work, because the irony is that all the stuff we do comes out of a particular cultural context. So if you take it and go to the suburbs and do it, well, what is it anymore? You know, it doesn't have the reason to exist. So obviously that doesn't work. But what I think that we have are really good questions. So what the answers end up being is going to differ according to context. But the question of how do you characterize the people in your cultural context, and given that, what does it mean to be church, is really important. And we've kind of lost that because we're so busy, I think, being church in the 50s or something, that we've, you know, that all of a sudden we're not asking that question anymore. So I think that is important. The other thing is that, and I always start my talks with this, and I can't believe I didn't this time. Sorry. This is how I always start. There's nothing ideal about my church. Okay. So hear me clearly. We have the same number of problems as every other church. I just created them. I didn't inherit them. Right? So there's the same number of problems. They're just, sometimes they're the same problems, but a lot of times they're different ones. So there's nothing ideal. It's fun and wonderful and exciting, but we have a lot of problems. So in terms of young adults, here's the deal. My friends, people in my context, they're interested in creating things for themselves. They're not interested in consuming a religious product that someone's created based on what they think they want. This is a huge difference between baby boomer culture and Gen X and Gen Y culture. Baby boomers have been marketed to, have their entire lives, and they love it. They're grateful. If you do market research and you realize what a baby boomer is going to need in 2 months, and you advertise to that and you provide that product, they're like, I love you and I'm going to be loyal to your brand. So, which is fine, but it could not be more different. If my friends suspect that you are marketing to them, they will resent you. They'll resent it. So it comes out of this great impulse. It comes out of this, like, we want you to be part of us, right? But like I said last night, during that 10 years I didn't go to church, there was nothing a church could have done or offered or been that would have gotten me in the door, no matter how well-meaning they were. It wouldn't have happened. So it's hard, you know? But I think the best shot that you have as a traditional church, if you want young adults, is to give away your power. If at any point you can give away power and decision making and money and say, we trust you, we believe that you are the church too, and we want to help you create something that will be meaningful for you, then you might have a shot. But it's really hard. I had this situation, and God bless them, the women of the ELCA, where they, at a triennial gathering years ago, decided they were going to have a special track for young women. And it was great because they let us on the planning team, young, I was young then, I said it was a while ago, that the young women on the planning team have budget and decide what they were going to do. And we did, it was a great experience. We did all this stuff. The young women who came were found it really transformative, and they were like crying because they felt like there was a space for them in the church and all this stuff, right? They never did it again because the women who were in charge didn't understand what we did. They didn't get it. They thought it was irreverent. They couldn't understand why we were painting each other's toenails, whatever, you know? They didn't get it, and they never did it again. And I felt like saying, if your organization is dead in 20 years, don't come to me. So you have to give it away. You have to try, like, you have to trust the people, and then you have to give away power, and then you have to continue trusting them after you've given it away. Give them money, continue trusting them after that. But to take it away, it's like,
You used a phrase the other day describing the church that you were big on participation.
Yeah, we're anti-excellence, pro-participation. So we don't do anything very well, but we do it together.
Unless Lutheran churches are vastly different from Methodist churches, which is where I am right now for whatever reason. But, you know, I can see a suburban congregation sitting down, and they have these planning committees, and they have retreats on how we're going to attract these edgy young adults, and, you know, and there's all kinds of really happy things going on, but I can't see them really wanting it once they get there.
Yeah,
you know, I can't see that congregation, the ones who tithe, the ones who are, you know, giving the money, the ones who are building that new wonderful annex or whatever, being happy.
Yeah.
The transformation that's going to happen
totally.
Once those people actually do come into your church. So if you're a pastor, I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
You know, but
instead of the message being like, how can we get them to come and be part of us because we're the church? What if you go to them and you say, guess what? You're the church. Now get busy. What's that going to look like? You know, like that might excite people. But like I was talking about that cultural commute, you know? So all that stuff I listed up here, those are like cultural things, you know? That not, some of them are present in traditional churches, certainly, but probably not all, you know? And so instead of saying, in order to be the church, you have to come and be part of me, the message was, you are the church, so get busy. Yeah.
I hear what you're saying.
Last one, and then are we out of time?
I hear what you're saying about allocating pastor time, because I felt that a little bit this year. Our lead pastor has been for about 2 years doing a young adult Bible study every Sunday, and I started noticing, I didn't notice it much the first year, but this year I noticed he's never doing a Bible study, and so
just not with you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then I started going, but of course if you know, they kind of invited a few people, kind of were gut out. Was really good.
Yeah.
It's a really good Bible study because these kids are in school. They're
unafraid.
Oh man, yeah. Do they have juicy? You talk about a fun Bible study.
It's fun. Yeah.
It's
well,
so
the Bible is hysterical.
So, but
I love that thing about being willing to share your pastor. There's a church called Scum of the Earth Church in Denver, and terrible theology, but they. It's all these street kids and skate punks and bike. I mean, it's just incredible. And that's how it started. Was this guy was like, I'm kind of gonna take this idea of parish really seriously, and I'm gonna be a pastor in this parish, and I'm gonna be present. I'm gonna go to all the events. People are gonna hang out in these places. People, you know, and that he started a Bible study with this like ska band, and then that's the origin of that church. So I think that idea of sharing your pastor is brilliant. Well, we have one couple who's 53, and then we have this man who's 67, and then everyone else is 20 to 42, and they're mostly 90% single people, maybe 20% are Lutheran, a lot of post evangelicals.
How many of your people were confirmed in the past?
Confirmed, maybe 20%. Yeah. 25. Yeah. So, yeah, they aren't Lutherans, so.
No, Lutherans.
Yeah.
I just wonder how many dropped out of other churches.
Yeah, you know.
After they graduated.
I would say, here's what I say. You know what would be the most missional thing you could possibly do? Recatechize all your adults. Best thing you could do. Because Lutherans have no idea what they're sitting on. So, I mean, that's your best hope for, like, being missional, is having people really have this understanding of how beautiful this tradition is. Being able to articulate it. So. All right, thanks so much.